Hello, and welcome to Powering Through Life. I'm your host, Teresa Sims. My mission is to share the wide range of strategies people have discovered and adopted to power through their lives. Every Friday at 2 p.m., I will have a new guest with interesting stories and topics to share. Join me on Encouraging You Radio, Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern, to learn, become inspired, and motivated. Welcome to Powering Through Life. I'm your host, Teresa Sims, and together with my guests, we share stories from people who have gone from tragedy to triumph. Each week, we learn new and important ways of powering through life. Today, my guest is Roberta Brown. Roberta, was born and raised in Minneapolis, Minnesota. She always has written, whether it be in journals, short stories, or business letters, with a clever twist. Roberta's obsession with Cher and Cher's fingernails led her to go into cosmetology school and get her manicuring license. After being in the beauty industry for 20 years, an anxiety disorder forced her to change direction. Roberta reinvented herself and started her own business as a marketing consultant. Working from home and business is still going strong. The Shooting, A Story of Resilience and Hope, is her first book. Roberta continues to live in Minneapolis area with her cats, better known as her fuzzy children. Roberta, welcome to Powering Through Life.
Thank you for having me, Teresa.
Oh, I'm so excited to have you here. I've actually read your book, The Shooting, A Story of Resilience and Hope, and I am so moved by your story. It was incredible what you have gone through and triumphed from.
Thank you.
So please tell our listeners why you call yourself The Shooting.
Why the book is called The Shooting?
Yes, the book is called The Shooting.
because I spent a lot of time telling myself I should be doing this because that's what people would expect of me, particularly my parents and my sister, if I could just stay under the radar and stay on their good side, then I wouldn't have any problems with them. So I spent a lot of time saying, well, if I just did this, that should get me through that, and I should say this instead of that. And that's how the shooting came to be. I spent a lot of time preoccupied with shooting on myself, as I say.
Interesting. So what caused you to feel that you had to, you should do this or you should do that? Or what was the story behind that?
Well, I was raised in this crazy, abusive atmosphere. You would have never known it. On the outside, our family had a certain way that they were presented to the public, and that is not at all what was going on behind the scenes. I had a father that was full of rage and was beating me up, and I had a mother who was complicit in that, and then later on I figured other things out about my mother. And a sister who was also physically and emotionally abusive. So it wasn't a happy atmosphere. The three people I was living with, my parents and my sister, were narcissists, and I was not. So I never really understood why everything revolved around them. And it was all about them, and I was sort of an outsider.
It's a difficult situation to be in when mm-hmm. you feel like you don't belong. Everyone else in your immediate family is this way, and you're totally different, and you don't know whether you're the right one or you're the wrong one or where you fit in that.
Exactly.
So what happened? What did you do with how did you cope with what went on in your home?
Well, that's an interesting question because I only lived where I lived. So I just thought everybody lived the way I did. It never occurred to me that anybody's life was any different. I just figured, you know, all my friends probably were doing the same things, and we just never talked about it. So I never talked about it. I just tried to stay safe, and there just wasn't a safe place for me. So that it's an interesting question because, you know, my awareness of what was going on, I certainly knew that there was abuse, but I didn't really understand and call it that. It just was how it was.
Yeah, it's difficult when you don't know any other way and you just think that's the way it is, but you don't understand why it's happening, why they're being so mean. How was it when you went to your friends' homes? I mean, you must have seen the difference in the parenting styles.
Well, I think that my parents presented a completely different front when my friends were over, you know. It never occurred to me that it was any different.
What about when you went to their homes?
But same thing. I mean, I just figured their parents were presenting a front, and who knows what went on when I wasn't there.
Oh, I see.
And I know that my best friend's family was quite dysfunctional, and her parents were difficult, to say the least. And her father was abusive, and she had quite a large family, certainly compared to mine. And some of them got along, and some of them didn't. And so it was hard to gauge what her home life was like.
Right. So, can you give us one example of an event that occurred in your life that caused you maybe massive anxiety or, you know, confusion or hurt? Can you describe something for us?
Well, there's several things, but I think I know where you're going with this. I think I was 16. Is this where you want me to go with this?
If you're comfortable with it,
I am.
Sure. Okay.
It's fine. It's, you know, I wouldn't say comfortable. It just is.
Yeah.
I was sitting watching a documentary in the kitchen, eating lunch or something. There was 10 minutes left of the documentary, and it was a weekend. It could have been a Sunday, maybe not. That's immaterial anyway. But I heard my parents starting to fight with each other, which never is a good thing, because then that means that they're going to pull me into it somehow. That's what they used to do, is pull me into their fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard my mother say, "I want it done now." And my dad walked into the kitchen and said, "Your mother wants you to clean your room." And I said, "Well, if you give me 10 minutes so I can finish watching this, I'll go down there as soon as it's done." And she yelled up the stairs, "I want it done now." And he said, "Do it now." And things were getting a little testy and ugly. And I think I lost my mind for just a moment, and I dropped the F-bomb. I swore at my dad, you know, and that's something I must have lost my mind momentarily. And he snatched me off my chair by the hood of my sweater and was choking me with my sweater. He dragged me into the living room and started to pound my head into the floor over and over and over again. And I was blacking out, and all I could think of was, "I'm going to die here. This time he's going to kill me." And somewhere in there I came up with, "He's not going to mean to, but he's going to kill me if I don't get away." And I'm not sure how I got away, but I did get away, and I ran out the door with just the clothes on my back and no shoes. And I was disoriented, and back then there were no cell phones, so I don't even know where I stopped to make a call. But I called my boyfriend at the time, and he found me wandering around the neighborhood. I was really out of it. And he took me back to his dorm room at the university, and the resident advisor took one look at me. I was so swollen and so beaten up, and she ran for ice and they packed my head and my neck and my shoulders in ice and said they were calling the police, and I begged them not to because that would just make things worse.
Yeah.
And I lived out at the university dorm for I don't know how long, maybe a couple weeks, maybe longer. And I drove myself to high school every day so I would graduate. But I didn't come home. I didn't go home until, I think, 2 weeks later. And then they wouldn't let anybody come in the house and help me take my stuff out because I left and moved out.
Is that the last time you stayed at home then?
I think I went back once when I had gotten myself into yet another abusive relationship, which, you know, is a whole, you know, it's a whole dovetail off of, you know, being in an abusive home, picking the wrong people in your life.
Yeah.
And I think I came home and my life was in danger. So, it, you know, it sounds kind of odd, but, you know, I was trying to find a safe place.
Well, it's the lesser of the, I hate to say the evils, but it's the lesser of the, you know, the most serious. So you pick which one is the most safe, not necessarily the safest. But
well, and the guy who took me out to his dorm, we ended up living together while I was still in high school. We were caretakers at an apartment complex, and he beat me up one night. And I sat there thinking, okay, what's more humiliating, having your boyfriend beat you up or having your father beat you up?
Mm.
And I decided that having your boyfriend beat you up wasn't as bad as having your dad beat you up. So I stayed in that relationship.
That must have taken a lot of courage, but I can understand that, you know, it. At the same time, you probably didn't really know where to go, did you?
I had nowhere to go.
Yeah.
I didn't have any money. I didn't, you know, I just had my stuff. And all I wanted to do was live a life that I felt safe, and that wasn't happening.
And how did it feel for you going back to high school? Was there any bullying? Was there any shaming?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Can you describe a little bit of that?
Well, you know, in my book, I write about the mean girls. And it's the same five girls. If you ask anybody from the year that I graduated with, they name the same five girls, five women, who still have not changed to this day, which is astounding.
Yeah. That's incredible. That, some people, I think, are just born that way.
Oh, my gosh. I went to my 30-year high school reunion, and they were awful. And they were awful at the 20 and awful at the 10, and my 40-year high school reunion is coming up in a few months, and I'm not going. I have had enough. You know, I'm not paying money to see those people anymore. But anyway,
yeah.
I digress. But, you know, people were wondering, you know, why I was living with a boyfriend while I was at high school. And these, you know, it was particularly these five girls who were just relentless with me. And from kindergarten all the way through high school.
Oh, boy.
And then really after high school as well, if we ever ran into each other. One who I ended up being related to when my father remarried after my mother died.
Oh, that
makes
it even worse.
Which is so crazy. I thought, really, God, is this your sense of humor? is this a test?
Maybe it was a test for her.
Well, and she hasn't changed at all.
Oh, so she didn't learn. Okay.
No.
Well, I know, I hate to say it, but it was in the 70s, correct, when this was going on? So
it was, yeah.
There was a kind of a stigma around girls that were living with their boyfriends and all that sort of thing. So that must have, you know, created even more difficulty for you and uncomfortableness.
Certainly, and I didn't discuss anything. Nobody knew what was going on in my house. And my biggest fear, and this is funny because I didn't discuss this in my book, but it really sort of lays in the background of everything, that I was, I didn't discuss it, and I thought if I told the wrong person, they would call child protection, whatever child protection was called back then. Mm-hmm. And they would take me out of my house, and I would end up in this even worse situation. But then my parents, who were great at putting up this sweet front of what wonderful people they were, they would somehow talk the Child Protective Services people into the fact that I was lying, and I would be taken out of the foster care system or whatever and brought back into my house.
Yeah, because at that time, children weren't always believed when
exactly.
they told stories, and that's what they were mm-hmm. considered were stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it's very unfortunate because there were a lot of children that needed a lot of help at that time and
mm-hmm.
were kind of just, I don't know for whatever reason, but I suppose they can't help everyone. But
unfortunately, and it was just, I just could not figure out what was going on. It took me years of therapy to understand what had happened, and it was much, much later in my life that I put all the put the final piece together and went, "Oh my God! Oh, now it all makes sense."
So you weren't you didn't have constant memories of all of these episodes?
No, I have PTSD, and I would fugue out and. And I think that self-protection, you minimize things
mm-hmm.
so that you can you can live your life day to day.
Yeah, it's almost like you're justifying it to yourself so that
yeah.
you can keep going it's really not that bad. It's just I'm just making too much out of it or whatever. But I think that's sometimes what we're programmed to believe as well.
And I think there's just a little piece in, and I can only speak for myself, but I've heard it from others when I've brought it up. There's like this little voice in the back of your head that goes, it wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And again, I think that's self-protection. I don't think that's you denigrating yourself in any way. I think that you're just trying to make it okay in your head that, you came through this, but maybe it wasn't that bad, and I hate that little voice.
Yeah, we need to silence that one for sure.
Oh, yeah, and I try, and it doesn't come up very often anymore.
Oh, that's
but,
good.
Like, when I do an interview and I start talking, when the words come out of my mouth and I think, whose life am I talking about? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do, actually. And I don't know if you felt that when you wrote your book, but I've certainly felt that way now.
Yes. And it's really, there was a part in my book that I wrote that I swear it was channeled somehow because I didn't realize how deep my feelings were about this particular thing. And it all wrote out, and I read it, and I went, oh, my God, I really do feel that way. But I had never put it on paper or even said it out loud.
Mm.
And it was really remarkable after I read it that my dad was a little league coach, and he loved being a little league coach. And he had two girls, and girls didn't play on Little League in the 60s and, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Right.
And I threw a mean curveball one day, and he said, how did you learn how to do that? I said, I don't know. I just do it. So I played tennis, and I played golf, and I played volleyball, and I did all kinds of things. I was the closest thing to a jock my father was going to have. He loved coaching. He loved Little League, loved it. And we went to a reunion of Little League, I can't even tell you, maybe 15, 20 years ago. He's been gone four. So maybe 15 years ago. And all these young men he coached were coming up to him and saying, you're the reason I am the man I am today. And I'm sitting there, and they're going on and on about what a fine person my father was and what he had taught them for being f- fulfilled young men. And I was just sitting there. And when I wrote my book, I had never gotten any further than I was just sitting there. And out came, what a bitter pill to swallow. I wonder how these men would feel if they knew that their hero coach was beating the crap out of his daughter.
Yeah, exactly. And did you sit there and think, who are they really talking about?
Yes.
That can't be him.
Well, but I knew it was him because this is who he is to people who don't really know him.
I see.
So there's a certain man that lived in the house, and there was a certain woman, my mother, who lived in the house. And then there were these facades of who appeared in front of other people.
Mm.
And I wrote this whole section, and I could hardly breathe when I read it back. It was fascinating to me. It was like a case study.
So was that very healing for you then?
It was painful, and it was healing, and it was sad, and it was enraging.
I can imagine. There's so many emotions that are
yes.
bundled up into all of these events that happen to us. And, you know, when you start letting them loose, it's incredible what happens.
Yeah. So it was really, I was so stunned by my own writing. I know that sounds crazy, but I was the depth of feeling, you know, because I really sat there and had to suck it up all night. At this, it was either a dinner or an event where all these men my age were coming up to my father saying, I am who I am today because of you.
Oh, boy. That must have been so difficult. I can't imagine.
So I just, like all the air went out of the room.
Mm. So what did you do in your efforts to find your whole person and to become a healthy whole person after these traumatic events? What type of therapy did you have? Did you write? Did you, what did you do, Roberta?
Lots and lots of therapy. 31 years plus. And 31 years with the same therapist, which is fabulous. And he writes the intro to my book, the foreword. I'm really not seeing him anymore. Ever since I wrote the book, I really haven't felt a big need to go and, sit and talk with him. But we've remained friends. I mean, now we've sort of transitioned after all these years. And after all these years, it's kind of a blurred line anyway. When you see someone, every 3-4 weeks for 31 years.
Yeah.
And, so it was a lot of work, a lot of digging in. But I didn't talk to him about a lot of the specifics. When we were first in therapy, when I was first in therapy with him, he thought I had been sexually abused because of my acting, the kind of acting out that I had done and things that I was talking about. He was pretty sure. And he did finally ask me many years into therapy, and I said, oh, no, exactly the opposite. I was, it got to a certain point where, my father didn't want to have anything to do with me unless he was screaming, yelling, or hitting me. So it wasn't like that. But my dad, in words, was sexually inappropriate. Mm. He would just say the most sexually inappropriate things, and I would just shrink. I just could not believe. And up until a few years before he died, he would continue to do that, and finally I just had enough and said, you're disgusting. And that was, probably 5, maybe 6 years ago.
Wow.
He said something wildly inappropriate to me in front of people. And I stopped what I was doing, and I turned around, and I said, you're disgusting.
Good for you.
I am your daughter. I don't care how old I am. I am your youngest daughter. Mm. Don't talk like that around me.
Congratulations.
Oh, it was horrid.
It must have been, but it took a lot of courage, lady, to be able to do that, and good for you.
Oh, it was horrid. It was just, and he looked at me like I was insane.
And he probably not used to being spoken to like that.
I'm terrified. I was terrified. He died. He was 94 years old, and I was still terrified of him.
Oh, my goodness.
And I spent a lot of time taking care of him in his later years.
That must have been an incredible challenge for you.
Oh.
It speaks to the volume of your caring heart, though.
Well, maybe my expectation of myself. And I say that because I was shoulding.
Mm-hmm.
I should do this, you know. And on his deathbed, I forgave him for being a terrible father. He squeezed my hand. He heard me. And then all hell broke loose during the will. And he took me out from the grave. So insane, I was destroyed by the will. And he decided that he was going to make me a completely separate paragraph and name me as, deficient, mentally deficient, or something like that. And that I couldn't have any money till I was 55, and that his accountant would be the executor of my money. And there wasn't any money to speak of. And the executor was sexually inappropriate with me in his office years before my dad died. And he was actually my accountant, and he was my father's accountant. And he was sexually inappropriate with me, and I left him and went to somebody else as my accountant. So now this man was in charge of my money, and there wasn't any.
That's horrifying all in its own.
it's
you know.
Crazy.
Oh, my goodness.
And so once, I mean, if you could have read the separate paragraph of being whatever he called me, and the thing was, I was supposed to get my money when I was 55. There wasn't any money to speak of. There were some insurance policies, but that's it. And I was 54 and a half when my dad died.
So it was, it was just a matter of very much anyway. So like a year and a half or half a year.
6 months. And the executor decided it was okay to get my money.
Oh.
So as soon as all the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed, and I made sure that all the insurance policies, and believe me, it wasn't a lot of money, I promise you, I wrote him a letter saying, the day that you were sexually inappropriate was the day you broke my heart. You were supposed to be like my brother and take care of me. Mm-hmm. And I ended my relationship with him that day.
And did you hear from him?
Never again. He can't even look at me. When he runs into me, he can't even look me in the eye.
Guilt is a very difficult thing, isn't it? Yeah, exactly.
Not my problem.
Nope. So good for you. You talk in your book of family of choice. Do you want
yes.
to explain that? That's part of your healing process, isn't
that
it?
That is part of my healing process. And now you're kind of becoming family of choice.
I like that part.
I have had the same friends for over 40 years, most of them, and they have loved me through thick and thin, through crazy and not crazy, through all the abuse, all the wrong choices of men, but that's not just my story, that's some of their stories as well.
Mm-hmm.
I have people who are very protective of me, and I couldn't ask for a nicer bunch of people. And I have chosen the right people to be in my life now. And I've had to let many people go because they're not healthy for me. They're not good for me. They need me. They have assigned me a role in their life, and they can't see me any other way. And those are the people that I've had to let go, which has been very difficult.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I've had to actually do the same, and very recently Actually, on the weekend, I just had to do it again. So
I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, it was actually for the good.
Well, of course it is, but
you know, yeah,
if definitely. You're anything like me, it is a hardship, even though that's the right thing to do.
Absolutely. You grieve the loss of that friend.
Certainly, and I have a friend who was a friend for 42 years. Her birthday is tomorrow, and I haven't spoken to her in months, and I am so sad by that, sad about that, and I know it's her birthday, and I can't start up this thing by saying even happy birthday, because it opens the door for her to continue to be the way she was being.
Yeah.
And until, you know, and I said to her, you know, when you figure out, you know, how you've been speaking to me and how you're treating me, I will be more than happy to take your phone call.
And, you know, the sad part is it doesn't have to be just friends. That happens to family members, too.
And I haven't spoken to my sister in over 4 years. We're coming up on 5 years soon. And I can't. She's abusive, and I write about our relationship, and it's not really calling her out; it's calling her behavior out, how her behavior affected me.
Yeah.
But I understand that some people can't separate that. Mm-hmm. You know, they think that if you're calling out their behavior and you're saying to them, "You're hurting me," and if you can't see it clear to stop hurting me, I'm going to have to let you go.
Mm-hmm.
And they continue to hurt you, and that's their choice, then you have to let them go.
Exactly. And we are very much alike. I have to had to do that about 29 years ago with my sister. So, you know, it was a choice, but, you know, we try to mend the relationship. And when one doesn't see the other one for who they truly are, and will not refuse to accept who that person has become, then, you know, it's just not right. It doesn't matter if you're blood. It doesn't matter.
Well, I'm going to reiterate for the listeners as well that some people need you assigned to a role in their life. You need to fulfill what they want you to do and how they want you to act in order to be part of their life.
Yes.
And for me, you have to kind of like me warts and all.
or
someone who is growing. And sometimes you just outgrow people.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And they don't keep up.
That's true. Very true.
And that's, and as much as, I think that, you know, and I've talked about this several times in different interviews, that women are self-blamers.
Mm-hmm.
It's automatically our fault. Even if it's not our fault, it's our fault. And what could I have done differently? Yeah, exactly. What could I have done different so they wouldn't treat me that way?
Yeah.
It's like, what? So I've now awakened to the fact that, you know, that is whatever role people need you to be in, and you've moved on from that, it's not your problem.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make it easy, though. Just saying that doesn't make it easy.
No, that's true. It's very hard. It's a hard choice to make. But, you know, it's your survival and your life that is almost dependent on that. So you need to make the right choices for you.
Well, the upshot from the book, I just found this out, and I don't think I've even told you the story, but I just found out my sister knows about the book, and I had no idea. And it's not like I've kept the book a secret. You know, I've been on book tour. I've done all these interviews and book events, and it's on, you know, Facebook and Twitter and, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And evidently, I got it fifth hand through several cousins that she thinks that I have written a tell-all book about her.
Oh.
And there's maybe 7 pages dedicated to her behavior and how it affected me.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, it could be, maybe it's 8 pages. It's not very long.
No, but it's you do tell the story well, and you know, it's incredible how people just, you know, when you're trying to do something right for you,
mm-hmm.
People just don't understand.
Mm-mm. So I was just stunned at how this all became about her. And the funny thing is, my closest friends, each one of them said to me, "Why are you the only one surprised? You're the one who called her out as being a narcissist." And like, it's like the light bulb went on. I went, "Okay, I get it." So what she did was prove my point.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is crazy.
It's funny, you know, how there can be one person in a family that is so different than the rest,
mm-hmm.
and yet, you know, we're ostracized or humiliated or beaten because we are different.
Exactly.
The rest, and that's not the way life should be.
Well,
you know, I don't think that's the way it should be. And I, in my bubble, it doesn't work that way. But,
No. In a perfect world, it shouldn't be that way.
No.
And the other interesting observation I make about myself is when I watch, like, The Voice or the Olympics, and these parents have moved cross country with their children to support their dreams.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, who would I have been?
Yeah.
Had I had parents like that?
Yeah. That's amazing, isn't it, to think, you know? Oh, geez, yeah. You know, and you were very athletic, as I was, and,
uh-huh.
you know, like, I don't remember my parents ever or rarely attending anything I did. And, you know, it's just, okay, a little acknowledgement would have been good.
Mm-hmm.
And here are these families, like you say, moving countries. And, yeah, it's just.
And I just sit there, and it sticks in my craw somehow. And I'm a healthy person.
Yeah,
but every once in a while, there's like a story, and I go, "Ah, what must that be like to live in the supportive atmosphere?
Yeah,
where amazing. You're truly loved,
yeah.
and you're safe."
Well, you know, I don't think it was meant to be for you and I when we were young. But
well, we wouldn't be who we are now.
That's right.
And that's all I have about that because.
Yeah.
You know, yes, I say, well, geez, where would I have been if I had this family? Well, I like where I am.
Well, you wouldn't be with us now.
No, and I like me just fine. But it took years to like me just fine.
It is a journey of healing, isn't it?
It is. It certainly is. And
well,
I was terrified to release the book. Terrified.
Oh, but I liked your book. I highly recommend The Shooting. It's a very good book.
Thank you.
We will have it up on the website for the radio station and on my personal website as well. And
thank you.
We hope to share it. So, Roberta, what would you tell someone who is in a situation they're struggling with, maybe an abusive relationship with their boyfriend or parents? What would you tell them? What would you suggest that they try or do or...
Well, there's therapy. There's therapy if you can see your way clear to do that.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't, you know, it's hard to be in the forest and, you know, in the trees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to see your way clear. I think my biggest thing is breathe, you know, just and try to give yourself some kind of positive reinforcement, which is really hard to do because you think of yourself as this terrible person. How could I be, you know, how could I think I was such a great person when these people treat me this way? And then you have to think your way out of it. You have to sort of understand that your self-worth is at stake. And, you know, in my case, I didn't have any. That was my problem. You know, I didn't understand that I was a worthy person. I must have been this terrible person for how I was treated.
Yeah.
And so I guess there's books to be read. There are And now there's support groups online where you're anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can get away to use a computer and, you know, and not put yourself in harm's way. But know that you're not alone, I guess, is the one thing I can say, because I know that in my book, I just want people to know you can come out on the other end. It takes a long time. It takes a lot of work. You have to dig in and give yourself those positive messages that you never got.
Well, you have to give yourself time, too.
And time and patience. And, yeah. You know, patience, I want it now, damn it. I mean.
Exactly. And there's a lot of self-compassion that goes along with that. And that's actually something I'm just learning, is the art of self-compassion, because I had no clue.
Well, and this is how you end up choosing the wrong people in your life, and this is how you end up staying in bad relationships, because if you didn't have a model of a good relationship or a supportive atmosphere, you're going to end up, generally speaking, having a lower self-esteem and thinking that you deserve to be treated that way because that's the way it was when you grew up. I think now, more than ever, there's more resources.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got your book coming out, my book, then we've got Becky Norwood's book.
Yes.
Both of her books, We Choose to Thrive, is really a wonderful book.
It is, yes.
As is The Woman I Love. And plug.
That's okay.
But there's there are mental health centers that you can go to that take a sliding pay scale or treat for free for a little bit. There are shelters to go to if you're in an abusive relationship. It's just a matter of doing it safely and not putting yourself in harm's way.
I would agree. And, you know, that first step is a monumental step. It's
monumental.
Huge. Yeah, but it is the first step to healing and to coming out on the other side of it, because it is possible. It is very possible.
Well, and I always say the light at the end of the tunnel isn't necessarily the light from an oncoming train.
Very true. Sometimes it's a good light.
Sometimes it's the light you need to go to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Roberta, I really want to thank you for joining us today, or joining me today. And like I say, everyone needs to read The Shoulding by Roberta Brown.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And I think we should do this again, and we'll have you back.
I would love to come back, and thank you so much. I appreciate it. You've been very gentle and kind.
Well, you know, it's a difficult subject at a lot of times, and I think it's important to be gentle with it and, you know, to help people, support them to talk, to break the silence, and that's what it's all about.
Well, and I think that's it. You know, we're only as sick as our secrets, and sitting on these secrets is no good for anybody.
Absolutely not. I agree. So, again, thank you, Roberta. I really do appreciate you having you here. And thank you for listening to Powering Through Life. So join me again next Friday at 2 p.m. on Encouraging You Radio.
Thank you for listening to Powering Through Life. Powering Through Life is designed to help my listeners discover new ways to encourage happiness and fulfillment in their lives. Join me, Teresa Sims, each week on Encouraging You Radio to learn how you too can power through your life. 'Cause I got angels on my side.